It's Crime and Time.
On the rocks.
And we're going to rock you.
Because we're on the rocks.
And we're going to rock you like a hurricane. I sang that in completely wrong.
That song has been going through. The Hit Me Like a Hurricane has been going through my head.
So, as you might have guessed, we are doing the hurricane.
We're doing the hurricane.
So, it's a lot of ingredients. We got some light rum, dark rum, lime juice, orange juice, simple syrup, grenadine, and passion fruit puree, which I did not find. So, this is passion fruit nectar.
I see. It's a very pretty cross between peach and watermelon color.
Yes, and it's in my official hurricane glasses that are plastic, and my dog chewed on one of them. But nevertheless,
you can't tell they're plastic.
I didn't. Oh no, I was like, we didn't garnish, but we garnished with a cocktail umbrella.
Cocktail umbrella, yes.
So, all right, I'm gonna try it.
Okay, I'll try it after you try it.
Surprisingly, I like it better than I thought I would. I thought it would be super sweet. And it's more citrusy.
It is citrus. I will drink it.
Yeah, okay.
Along with my citrus.
I'm actually very surprised. I think the lime juice definitely brings out.
Yep. I can do this one.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and I did leave out the simple syrup in ours.
Yes, so put in simple syrup if you like something sweeter.
Yeah. I just was looking
at
all
the... How much simple
syrup? It was a half ounce, and I was looking at the ingredients, and I'm like...
That's a lot.
It's got grenadine in it. It's got orange juice in it. It's got passion fruit nectar. Like,
yeah.
I'm just going to say no on the simple syrup.
Going to be enough. We, however, if you're new to the podcast, are sweet enough. We don't need to add sweet. No, neither one of us like a sweet drink, so we often will edit the simple syrup. If you prefer a sweeter cocktail.
Yeah, do the whole recipe as is. I always include the recipe in our show notes as is, and then I usually remove some of the simple syrup or all of the simple syrup from ours. A lot of times, if it says a half ounce for two of us, that would be a full ounce, and sometimes I'll just do a half ounce for both.
Right.
But this time, it just had like lots of sweet stuff in it.
There's plenty of sweet stuff in it, and it's fine. I like the little citrus tang, but I'm a citrus girl. I have a friend who, I like the Costco White Claw, but it only comes in the case of all four flavors. So I have a friend who, she likes the two flavors that I don't. So when we go, we each buy two cases and then swap.
Which is super smart.
Mm-hmm. But she doesn't drink quite as much as I do, so.
Unfortunately. You have a backlog of the two flavors you don't like.
All right, sure.
I'll drink it. I like it.
I'll drink it. Okay, I'm going to tell you a story about some hurricanes, though. So my sources, I'll start out with five hurricanes that changed history, so that gives you a hint what I'm going to do. U.S. court rules shipwreck found off Florida coast is French flagship La Trinit, which sank in the 1565 Daily Mail Online.
That's a lot.
Say that time five times fast.
That's a lot of headline.
France and Florida agree. First Coast News, how a survivor 1609 shipwreck brought democracy to America. That story is awesome.
That sounds really interesting.
Zocalo Public Square, the hurricane that saved Jamestown, history.net. Hurricane sinks Spanish treasure ships, history. The 1715 Plate Fleet and the Rise of Pirates, history today. And the letter that Hamilton wrote that got him out of the West Indies from mental floss.
I'm here for all of that. That sounds fascinating.
This was one of my favorite ones to write this week.
It sounds okay. When you told me, because you did, you had to ask me a procedural question about this one.
Yes.
And when you told me it was about hurricanes, I did expect that, but then I'm like, oh, is this going to be boring? Like, or is it going to
be my natural disasters?
I was like, is this going to be boring or is this going to be a downer?
No, they're fun. I think they're
fun. But no, now hearing your sources, yeah. I'm excited.
Well, I was tempted to do Katrina because it's far enough in the past that it's
But that's such a
history,
downer.
But it's such a downer. And so I was just like, I wonder if there's a hurricane that ever changed history. And there's at least five. So hurricane number one, the hurricane that prevented Florida from becoming a French colony.
That was probably a good move, I guess.
Uh-huh. So more than a year after Pedro Menendez de Alvarez founded the Spanish colony of St. Augustine in September of 1565, French settlers had started their own colony there. They established Fort Caroline at the mouth of what is now the St. John River in present-day Jacksonville. However, Menendez was able to destroy the entire French colony with the help of a natural disaster. So just a few days after they founded St. Augustine, there was another fleet coming in commanded by Jean Ribault, and he was just kind of hanging off the coast, and he was demanding that Menendez surrender. So, because they're like, this is our colony, you surrender, go away. So, but before Menendez could even reply to Ribault, a hurricane comes through, blows all of the French ships south towards Cape Canaveral, completely wrecks them, and they sink. So now Fort Caroline is completely unprotected. There's only the citizens there. There's no supplies coming in. Menendez comes in, slaughters everybody, killed more than 130 people, and says, yeah, we're in charge.
Wow, that's brutal.
Yes.
I mean, I guess he took his opportunity, but...
Yes. So then they found a bunch of survivors, and they killed all them, too. Survivors from the shipwreck.
Yeah.
And killed all them, too. So the reason that we even know about this is in 2016, there was a shipwreck that was discovered off of the coast, and it featured a monument with Francis Fleur-de-Lis. It featured three... brass cannons with the fleur-de-lis on them, and they believe these to be the flagship of the three, the La Trinette, that was carrying the monument that was lost in 1565. They figured they were coming in to make a claim. We've got a little settlement here. We're going to put up a monument. We're going to protect it with our cannons. This is our property now. So there was apparently quite the controversy about the salvage company that found the shipwreck was like, hey, this is ours. And France said, no, it's not. It's ours.
It belongs to us.
And apparently there is a law that says if you can determine the country of origin that the shipwreck came from, it belongs to them. So it technically did belong to French. The judge ruled that and everything. And then they finally agreed to work together to bring the ship up, because the historical significance was too great. They didn't want to fight over it.
Well, I'm sure the salvage company had more experience in that sort of thing. So they probably got a good deal.
Yeah. So that's the first one. Now, my second hurricane is the hurricane that fueled the golden age of piracy.
That sounds... Okay, I'm all for this.
So I recently watched Starz Black Sails. Kind of became obsessed. Sort of binged it. Trying to get child number one to watch it with me, and she refuses to do it. It's where I found my latest secret crush, but I can't think of his name. But child number one has decided that I don't like... I've always had a thing for, like, bald guys. She says it's not bald guys, it's dirty bald pirate types.
Wow.
And if you think about my list, it kind of is, because I like the dudes from Vikings.
Yeah, she's not completely wrong.
She's not. I like dirty bald pirate types. Although that is not what husband is.
He's bald,
but he's not dirty. He's not a pirate type. But anyway, so this TV show features this plot line where there is a Spanish ship that is sunk off the coast of one of the neighboring islands from Barbados. And they're going to get this gold. It's called the Urca Gold. Well, it's not too far off, because that's really what happened. On July 31st, 1715, there was a dozen ships laden with jewels and gold and all kinds of stuff that they raped and pillaged out of Central and South America. Oh, did I say? I mean, that they took from South America.
Yeah, raped and pillaged from South America.
Right. So, and they're going along to take it home. And this, just off the coast of Florida, this huge hurricane comes in. It stinks all of the ships. Over 1,000 people died. So that's kind of a bummer. And they lost all of the treasure. About 80% had been recovered by 1716, but the rest remained lost until the 1960s.
Oh, wow. That's a long time.
That's a long time. But the part that came up in 1716. So on July 24th, there were these 10 ships that were headed to, they left Havana, Cuba, and they're on their way to Europe. They go by Florida. They had tons of gold and silver, 14 million pesos worth. The ships stayed very close to the Florida coast. And the French ship, the Griffin, ventured out a little bit further. And as they were going along, just a week later, they were between Cape Canaveral and Fort Pierce in modern-day Florida. And this is when the wind picks up. The hurricane comes in. It advanced quickly. And one by one, it wrecks all of the ships. So the Nuestra Señora de la Regal sank. 200 people died, 120 tons of coins. 120 tons of coins.
That's a crap ton of coins.
Crap ton of coins. The Santo Cristo de San Ramon went down with another 120 sailors on board, and they figure 700 to 1,000 people died. The Griffon was able to ride out the storm, and most of its crew survived. So, all of this treasure, bottom of the sea.
Sunk.
Yes. The wreckage was strewn over a 30-mile stretch of shallow waters. So now news of this reaches Jamaica by November. Remember, it sank on the 31st. So two vessels, the Eagle and the Beersheba, commanded by John Willis and Henry Jenkins, respectively, immediately sailed to Florida's coast, and they landed there. They raided the storehouse containing the treasure that the Spanish had managed to come up from the wrecks or pull from the wrecks, and this raid earned them approximately 120 pieces of eight, and they took that all back to Jamaica. So Jennings and Willis arrive with their ill-gotten gold, and everybody in Jamaica is just like, So Captain Belchin of the naval ship the Diamond, who was stationed at Jamaica, said, no, stop. He lost 10 guys that were part of his ship, just took off to go, they called it to go wrecking.
It was like a feeding frenzy.
Yes. They're like, oh, we have a job? No, never mind. Going to get, like the gold rush.
Yeah.
Going to get gold. Never mind. So he's like, we have to do something about this. So Lord Archibald Hamilton granted a commission to the Eagle and the Beersheba to go and get this gold. They said, execute all manner of acts of hostility against pirates according to the law of arms. And they instructed they gave them explicit commands not to attack anyone except the pirates who were stealing this gold. But Captain Jonathan Barnett of the Tiger Snow said, Hamilton had already planned a voyage to these wrecks. And not only that, he had investments in both the Eagle and the Beersheba. So he's pirating, and he's heavily invested in the ships that are going to stop the pirating.
He's double dipping.
Double dipping, yes. So they don't like that. So Hamilton's opponents obstruct the attempts to rein in the privateers, which just lets loose, you know, more guys are in getting this stuff. And so Hamilton needs to make himself look better at this point. So in April 1716, he sends two proclamations to make the Spanish happy. So it's in the show, it's a little bit different, but it's still very much the same. There's a captain who comes and he's trying to appease the Spanish. So he tells them one thing, but really he's doing another thing. Exactly what this Hamilton guy's doing. So he sends these proclamations, and the first one says that all commissioned vessels need to return to Jamaica with any effects that they had plundered, with the clear intention that they would be tried. And then the second one said, no British subjects may go fishing in these wrecks. No British subjects may partake in this. However, the effects of these proclamations are that colonial governors started receiving numerous complaints of pirate attacks on the ships that are bringing back this gold.
Because they're bringing back gold.
Yes.
I'm no genius, but...
Exactly. So this turned into all of these pirates kind of gathering in the Bahamas, and that started the infamous Pirate Haven, which housed and kind of bred and grew the legends of Edward Teach, Blackbeard, Calico Jack, Rackham, Charles Maine, all of the dudes in this TV show.
Oh, interesting, because it didn't have, like, I never thought about it before, but, like, the whole Pirates of the Caribbean, like, it didn't happen organically. Like, there was an event, and then they
all
came.
There was an event, and they were all there to get that gold.
Yeah.
And to get the ships that were getting that gold.
Interesting.
Yes. So the Bahamas pirates continued to raid the Florida wrecks until 1716. However, by early 1717, many had expanded their piratical operations to encompass all shipping that went around the Caribbean Sea. Because this is a throughway.
Yeah.
People are going in and out of there, and they're like, hey, this is a good spot. Let's hang here. So they did.
It's like their fishing hole.
Their fishing hole. So that is how a hurricane led directly to the pirate haven of the Bahamas. Hurricane number three. What hurricane? There was a hurricane that put Alexander Hamilton on the path to becoming a founding father. So this one cracked me up too, because this is, there in 1772, there was a bad hurricane that went through the Caribbean where Alexander Hamilton was living, and his father went through the town of St. Croix, and his father had just abandoned his family about 5 years before that, and teenage Hamilton was pissed that he and his family are having to deal with all of this garbage in this hurricane. So he is mad, and he wrote his daddy a letter about it.
He's all angsty.
It was, the letter is brilliant, obviously, but it's full of teenage angst, like, basically, get your ass down here and help us. It's your job.
He's not wrong.
No, he's totally not wrong. So anyway, he runs this letter past his friend, Hugh Knox, who was the Presbyterian minister of his church, and Knox thought it was brilliant. Knox had studied at Divinity at the College of New Jersey and was ordained at the institution by Aaron Burr's dad.
Aaron Burr. If you remember that commercial.
And so he's, you know, he's very influential, and he reads this letter from Alexander Hamilton, and he's like, this kid is smart. This kid has brilliant powers of deduction. He has great powers of persuasion. We need to do something to promote this kid. So he told Hamilton, yeah, it's a great letter. He also published it in the newspaper with the OG GoFundMe page.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, everybody, let's contribute money to send this kid to college because he's super, super smart.
Well, that's a cool, I mean.
Yeah.
Like we always say, people never change.
People never change. So they did exactly that. And he earned enough money through this crowdfunding campaign of people donating money to send him to a scholarship to off to the American colonies to go to school. And that is how he wrote his way into American history, by a pissed off letter to daddy.
And then people kind of like didn't think of him as one of the prominent founding fathers until Alexander Hamilton.
Until the musical.
Yes. Yes. And now he's back, baby.
And now he's back. All right. The next hurricane, second to last, is the hurricane that helped ensure victory in the American Revolution. Because half of a war is luck. So, the British navies are coming across the Caribbean ports, and this huge hurricane comes through. It's going through this Caribbean area. It was called the Great Hurricane, or the Big Hurricane, or the Hurricane of the Century, something. There's a bunch of different names for it. But it goes through, and it takes out all of these British vessels. Oh, the Great Hurricane of 1780. It killed approximately 22,000 people.
Oh my goodness.
This was the Great Hurricane of 1780. The British lost 8 ships and nearly all of their crew at the time. It was the deadliest Atlantic hurricane on record. It also claimed more than 40 French transport vessels and the lives of thousands of their soldiers. But this storm was able to move the British so that the French could come in and supply military support to the Patriots. And this is where we got the treaty with France to help us, because they were actually able to get to us to come and help us.
Thanks, French.
Yes. So they came in and they agreed with George Washington to move its ships northward, repairing their ships. And during the winter of 1781, the French then moved west with their vessels to the Virginia coast following the hurricane season. And after defeating the British naval forces, because they lost a bunch of ships, in September 5th, 1781, the French warships were then able to block the British escape during the siege of Yorktown. And that concluded the surrender of Lord Charles Cornwallis and effectively ended the revolution, because the British lost so many ships in the hurricane.
So basically, thanks to the French and the hurricane,
we are here.
We're here today.
Yes. But none of this would have happened had there not been a hurricane that hurt/saved Jamestown. And it also inspired a Shakespearean play.
Oh, wow.
So this is the one that I did the deep dive into. So June of 1609. There was a supply mission of 9 ships and approximately 500 new colonists that set sail to England to replenish the newly established Jamestown colony. There were women and children aboard. There was livestock, all kinds of material to really help this little English town in Virginia. They left the River Thames completely fully stocked. There was a... So on July 23rd, the reason that we know this is because there were several reports written about it, but one of them was the True Repertory of the Rack, W-R-A-C-K-E. Gotta love that old-timey spelling. And Redemption of Sir Thomas Gates Knight. It was written by the company secretary, William Starchy, who was a gentleman who hung out with the likes of Bill Shakespeare.
Oh, yeah. Him and Bill are tight.
Him and Bill were tight. So, on July 23rd, 1609, quote, a dreadful and hideous storm began to blow. A hurricane of unimaginable force took over the fleet, and they were just a week away from Chesapeake Bay, and they... The hurricanes thought it was a cyclone. Tropical storms were kind of new to them. And they thought that they had sailed beyond the border of God's realm.
Oh.
And they were being punished. Yes.
Oh.
They were in the wild territory of the devil. So for 3 days and three nights, they struggled against the wind and the waves. The smallest of the ships sank and all men were drowned. The Sea Venture that carried most of the supplies and the new general, who's going to figure prominently later, disappeared and they figured them for dead. There were seven ships that were actually made it into Chesapeake Bay. They kind of limped in. They were a mess. And when they got there, they found that Jamestown was not quite what they thought it would was. There was a man named John Smith, who everybody thinks of as a good guy, who had basically become a dictator and was sort of ruling with an iron fist. And under Smith's regime, they had kind of made this Powhatan Confederacy. These natives paid tribute with food and bivouacked with the settlers, but it was all kind of under coercion. So they didn't like that. On these seven ships that made it in was John Ratcliffe, and he deposed Smith after they landed, and Smith was wounded in this deposition. Yes, which doesn't sound so much like a deposition, more like a fight.
Yes.
But anyway, so he's wounded, and they are like, okay, we're going to fix this. So fix it they did. A lot of the new people that had come over on these shipwrecked ships were too gentlemanly for work.
Oh, gosh. They got some dandies.
So they didn't bother to plant crops. Some of them said, hey, we're going to go get some gold. And so they took off.
They could have kept going and they might have found some.
They might have. They lost a lot of the provisions in the storm. And then during the, quote, trial of Governor Smith, they didn't bother to plant or harvest or store anything, hunt and gather. So by the time they eat through the autumn harvest and they have nothing to replace it with, they're awfully hungry. This kind of coincides with a drought year, which also, you know, is bad. So the colony now starts really putting pressure on the Native Americans living there. Hey, you have to feed us. And Powhatan was like, no.
No, you don't understand how this works.
Yes. So he really sees this as like, whew, I can get rid of these ungrateful beggars. But his daughter Pocahontas does not want him to do that. And she really, really tries to convince Dad to save them. I did not know that her name in Algonquin means little wanton, which is a horrible thing to name your child.
Yeah, but is it any different than Liliuokalani?
Oozing sore eye?
Oozing sore eye?
Probably not. But anyway, so she actually helps them a little bit. And the reason that we know there was a drought during that time was through tree ring analysis, which is fascinating. But it was called
probably really boring to do. It's fascinating to hear about.
Right. I can't imagine that it would be exciting to do. But between 1609 and 1610, there was a very, very dry spell during that time, which also contributed to the food dwindling. So they continue to try to barter with the Indians. The Indians are done with it. And when John Ratcliffe goes in to finally say, hey, you got to help us, they just kill him instead. You know. tired of hearing you. Bye.
Yeah.
So
you said that. We heard you. We said no.
We're hungry too, and we're going to take care of our own people first. Thanks. So this is quite different from what's going on a few miles north or south. I don't know which. So anyway, the Native Americans along the James River rebel against the subsequent regime of George Percy, and now Jamestown has all of these mouths to feed and no one to do the work. Gentlemen are reduced to boiling their frilled collars to eat the starch.
Oh, heavens.
Yes. It reminded me a lot of...
Or they could just do some work.
They could do some work, but it's too late now because it's the middle of winter. You can't grow nothing then. It reminds me of the book that I read about the Donner Party where they boiled the soles of their shoes.
Yeah.
Because it was leather.
I didn't read a book about the Donner Party, but I listened to that. I think it was like a three-parter on Last Podcast on the Left, mm-hmm. which is really good, by the way.
Yes, it is really good. I've only listened to one of theirs, but I really liked it. So anyway, they're boiling their collars to get the starch. And then they eventually started to eat bugs. They started to eat horses. Then, oh darn, you're dead. Let's put you out in the snow and carve off a hunk.
They Donnered them.
They Donnered them before the Donner. The Donners Jamestowned them.
Yes. So, interestingly enough, I don't know if this is interesting, but I thought it was. When I was listening to that podcast episode, I was driving up to South Lake Tahoe.
Oh my and gosh.
So I was like on Donner Summit while they were talking about the Donner Party, which is like kind of eerie. I mean, I'm yes. on like a major highway, but it's still kind of weird.
Still be kind of weird. I think about that every time I go across that area.
Same.
Like,
and then just listening to that, which I put it on specifically because I'm like, oh, I'm going to be driving into the area. Like, I'd like to hear this story. But when I got up there and they're talking about
that's
it.
That's funny. I worked in a law office here in town, and one of the cases was a direct descendant, and they now live in tiny little town where I live because their license plate says it.
One of the direct descendants was one of my parents' neighbors.
Crazy.
Might be the same people, I don't
know. She told me all about, she was divorcing the direct descendant, but she told me all about it on the phone when I was talking to her at the attorney's office. But anyway, so they're Donnering each other. There was a settler accused of butchering his wife as he descends into madness from starving. There was the infamous, they called it the starving time, and it was bad. So meanwhile, in another part of the world, the Sea Venture didn't sink. It runs up onto an island, and they, it was bad, it was scary. So they're, the planks are ripping off the boat. The sealant that they use is just like spitting out everywhere. The sailors are trying to put salt beef, like beef jerky in the cracks to plug it up. Yep. They're pumping and bailing.
That's their food too.
That's their food. Yeah. But they're pumping and bailing and they're like, you know, we don't, because these are some of the gentlemen too. And they're like, we're just going to keep going. We know we're going to die, but we're going to keep just bailing stuff out. We're going to live as long as we can.
Well, good for them that they learned a lesson.
Yes. So just as they're like just about ready to give up, it literally said, the story that I read says their limbs could no longer work. They see land. So the Admiral steers the ship over to the reef, which is about a mile from shore, and 150 people made it out to the Bermuda Island. So they, whoa, I did it again. And my iPad
I'm like, your iPad's not working right.
It is not working right. Starving time. Okay, so 150 people made it there. And they get there. So Stranchy and Sir Thomas Gates, who is was to be the new governor of Virginia, order everybody to get the weapons, get the food. Let's get out. Let's see what we can salvage from the wreck. So they get onto the Bermuda Island, and they're like, whoa. There is fish. There are pigs. There are birds. There is fruit. This rocks. Let's stay here.
Yeah. Why go to Virginia when you can live in paradise?
Right. And one of these guys was like, yeah, why should we leave? We came for adventure. This is adventure. We wanted to survive. We wanted to be free from England to pursue our own religious freedom. Let's just do it here. But Governor Gates says, no. We have a contract with the company. This is what we're doing. I want you to get out there, get everything you can from the Sea Venture, bring it here, and we're going to fix this. Some of the settlers...
Overruled is what overruled. I would say.
Well, that's what somebody tries to get them to say. But he... Some of the settlers are like, no, we don't want to. And so he kind of threatens them. Some of them do pull a work slowdown and they just... blah, 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 blah. And they're afraid. They're like, we barely survived this. We don't want to go back out in the ocean. So they drag their feet. One group plotted to escape to another island and, like, maroon themselves in another island. But Gates hears about the plot. And so he hauls the conspirators before the assembled camp. And he convicts them for mutiny. And their punishment was to be marooned.
So they got what they wanted?
Kind of, but he didn't give them any tools or any supplies. He just stuck them on an island. And these are gentlemen. They don't know how to hunt.
Yeah, true.
So after a few days, they were like, okay, you win. We'll do what you say. So they knew they were prisoners. They knew that he had them over a barrel and he was going to make them do what they wanted. So they did what they were supposed to do. They had to eat all together. He kept a very good, tight control over the food. He kept a tight control over the people. They were never allowed to... rest unless he said they could rest. It was more like a labor camp than a settlement. By January 1610, they developed a new skeleton crew, but this Stephen Hopkins said, hey, you know what? We made a contract with... He was a 28-year-old who... He was kind of a low-level dude and he would maybe get to in a law office, and he sort of got to lead prayers in church, but he wasn't really listened to all that much. And he got to thinking, and he said, you know, we made a contract with the Virginia Company to go to Jamestown, and we would work for them. They sent us our passage to go to Jamestown, and we would work our passage off with our labor. We didn't get to Jamestown. They did not deliver us to Jamestown. They did not give us food. They did not give us clothing. We don't owe them our labor. And the people were like, oh, yeah, I see your point. That's a good point. So he was kind of preaching this whole,
like the Enlightenment thing. Yeah, the contract was broken because...
Yes, before it kind of got cool. But he said, we are freed from the government of any men. The poorest labor was only bound by the natural law of self-preservation for himself and his family. But he got not outvoted, but it didn't work because the guy...
They couldn't see. They couldn't understand the concept, basically.
Probably. And the guy had such control over them. He controlled their food. He controlled their leisure, everything. So they set out on May 1610. And there was spies and this whole thing, but they figured it out. And they set out on May 1610. They... called the new ship that they had built from the wreckage of the old ship, the Deliverance. And the settlers, of course, thought that was funny. It took them a week to get to Chesapeake Bay. When they get there, they find not a lot. It wasn't completely abandoned, but there's only 60 people left. Everybody else was nearly starved or gone.
Or eaten.
One of them, as they pulled up, one of them said, "We're starved."
They're like, we are too. We thought you would have stuff.
Yeah, we thought you'd have some food. But the Bahamas were so prolific with their food. They had meat and they had plants and they had all of this stuff. So they came in pretty well supplied. And they actually saved this company with their salted pork and their fruit and everything. So he's able to kind of bring them back to life. And he... spent a few months trying to get things going. There was always people that were deserting. Hey, no. Because again, he's running this camp the same way he ran the camp in Bermuda. It's kind of like a labor camp. So he had people that were running away. If they got caught, they would kill them in plain view of all the other settlers. They might take a man and chain him to a tree and not feed him. And if you fed him, you would be chained to the tree next to him.
Ooh, that's really harsh.
Yeah, it sounded just really, really bad. So he did this for months and months and months. And then finally he says, you know what? This isn't going to work. Let's just go back home.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So they start out, and when they start out, they see another ship coming to, quote, save them. And he's like, well, you're too late. We're there, we're gone, we're coming home. So the tale that was told about this went all around England, and Shakespeare hears it, because there's a lot of scenes from the shipwreck that are directly put forth in The Tempest. It premiered on the Blackfriars Theatre in London in the fall of 1611. The completed play was filled with magic and double meanings. It tells the tale of a storm and a shipwreck on a fearsome island that was turned into a paradise, and it saved everybody. There was the play's mutineer was a drunken named Stefano, but he was obviously taken after the other guy. And the political theorist was named Stephen Hopkins. It was taken after Stephen Hopkins, the Stefano person. So the original staging of the play had cannonballs rolling in and special effects. There were uncanny images like the Sea Venture sinking. There was a magical spirit named Ariel and intones of the still vexed Bermoots. The theater is, or the play is set in this mysterious island that was seemingly magical and beauty to dine on exotic cuisine. There was mutineers that were put down and an undrowned nobleman who is believed lost at sea but comes in to return as a savior at the end, like the governor did. And at the end, everyone is saved, and it says, "Oh, brave new world that has such people in it," as the beautiful Princess Miranda proclaims, who was Pocahontas.
Never knew this.
Yes. So the wealthy theatergoers watched Shakespeare's play ridicule the idea that common people might take responsibility over their own government, and The Tempest was first performed at Whitehall Palace on November 1st, 1611, before King James.
Uh-oh.
The king for whom Jamestown was actually named, and not just saved. We are such stuff. The play's main character winks as dreams are made on. Sometimes it's called his American play, and he, as it was suggested, to the glories of the new world to come, where men can govern themselves.
And look what happened. Foreshadowing.
Foreshadowing. So, five hurricanes that changed the history of at least our country.
Well, I got another hurricane for you.
Okay.
I'm going to tell you about Reuben Hurricane Carter.
Oh, okay.
So he was born in 1937 in Clifton, New Jersey. He was the fourth of seven children. At age 11, mind you, age 11 is very young.
Age 11 is very young.
He was sentenced to a juvenile reformatory after stabbing a man. To redeem him a little bit, he claimed that this man had been trying to sexually assault him. So,
okay.
Yeah. So in 1954, he escaped from the reformatory, and he was old enough to join the U.S. Army, so he did that. He completed basic training, and from there he was sent to West Germany. And in West Germany, he began to box for the army.
Okay.
Unfortunately, his army career didn't last long because he had four courts-martial, which I found out is the correct way to say it, not court-martials.
Four.
Four courts-martial. And then he was subsequently discharged from the army and labeled unfit for service.
You think?
Yeah.
Stabbing a dude at 11... escaping reform school, four courts martial.
Four courts martial.
Yeah, he's unfit.
Yeah. So anyway, he goes back to New Jersey, and after being back in New Jersey for just a little while, he is convicted of two different muggings, and he goes to prison.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So in 1961, he is released from prison, and then he says, "Hey, I guess I'll be a professional boxer now." So he goes and becomes a professional boxer.
Okay.
He is known for his aggressive style and his punching power. He had a bunch of early round knockouts, and he quickly began drawing crowds, and he was given the nickname the Hurricane.
Okay. Did he fight in one of the famous fights?
Perhaps. Okay. I don't know. I didn't really like go into his boxing career.
Okay. Because we've done Ali.
Yes.
I'm wondering if he, because that's about the same time, right?
He did not fight Ali that I saw, because I did look for that. Since we talked about Ali, I was like, did they fight each other? I did not see that they, well, he was a middleweight, so no, he wouldn't have.
Yeah.
In July of 1963, he was listed as one of the top 10 middleweight contenders in the boxing publication called The Ring. And in 1965, he was ranked as number 5.
Wow.
So his career record was 27 wins, 12 losses, 1 draw. And during that time, he had 19 knockouts.
Good for him.
So meanwhile, back to the reason why we're even talking about him.
His nickname.
So at approximately 2:30 a.m. on June 17th, 1966, two men entered the Lafayette Bar and Grill in Paterson, New Jersey, and they began shooting.
Oh my gosh.
The bartender named James Oliver and a customer, Fred Nyax, were killed immediately. Hazel Tanis died in the hospital a month later, and a third customer, Willie Marins, survived the attack, but he had no sight in one eye afterward. So at the time, all these customers like that were still in the bar that survived said that the two shooters had been black males.
Okay.
So 10 minutes after the murders, around 2:40 a.m., a police car stopped Hurricane Carter and his friend John Artis. They were returning from a different bar called the Night Spot. Carter was in the back seat, Artis was driving, and there was a third man, John Royster, in the passenger seat. And the police, because of who Carter was, recognized him, and they knew who he was, like, from his boxing career, but they also knew that he had some crime history.
Right.
But they let him go. So, minutes later, police were able to obtain a description of the getaway car from these two other eyewitnesses that were outside of the bar. They were not in the bar. The two people were Patty Valentine and Al Bello. So Al Bello later admitted that the reason why he was even in the area is because he was being a lookout for his friend Arthur Bradley, who was breaking into a warehouse next to the bar.
Okay.
So he said that after he heard the shooting, he went into the bar to buy cigarettes and discovered all these bodies.
So he was committing another crime next door, coincidentally, at the time of the crime.
Yes.
Okay.
So then his story is that he goes into the bar to buy cigarettes and finds all these bodies.
Because I always go into a place where I've heard major shooting. I'm like, oh, that's a great place to go get cigarettes.
Yeah. You know what? I could use a cigarette. Let me go to the place where a bunch of shooting just happened.
Seems they'll have cigarettes.
So while he's there trying to buy quote-unquote trying to buy cigarettes, he takes the cash register, or like empties the cash register.
Well, of course you do.
And he's running out when the police come in, and so he gets stopped, and he doesn't match the description of anybody, so you know he's free. So
oh my goodness.
During the trial that later happens, he said that he was approaching the Lafayette bar when two black males, one with a shotgun and the other other one had a pistol, they came around the corner, and he said that he ran from them, and he saw them get into a white car that was double parked near the Lafayette.
Okay, so just to recap, he is being a lookout for a friend who's robbing a warehouse. While he's sitting there, he hears a whole bunch of shots.
Decides to leave his post.
I need cigarettes.
To go get cigarettes.
He leaves his buddy, goes next door where he heard the shooting to buy cigarettes, sees all the dead bodies, decides, oh no, on the way from the warehouse to the bar where he's going to buy cigarettes, he sees two dudes.
Two black men.
Running with a gun and thinks, oh, look at them, get in that white car. Goes to the bar where he finds it full of dead bodies instead of cigarettes and decides, I'm going to take the money out of the register.
Ding, ding, ding. You're correct so far.
He's totally innocent. I don't know why you're talking about him.
So Patty Valentine, so she's the other person that described what she saw. She lived above the bar, so she's not that, I mean, she's not as sketchy. But anyway,
she just lived there.
She lived there. So she hears the shots, she looks out the window, and she said she saw two black men leaving the bar, and they got into a white car. And she said the car was white with a geometric design, kind of like a butterfly shape in the back of the car, like where the taillights are. And she said that the car had New York license plates because it was a blue background with orange lettering. And they're in New Jersey, which I think had white or green license plates. Uh-huh. I don't know.
I'm trying to think what the butterfly shapes would be for a 1960s car.
So they're saying that I don't know if I have it here later, but one of the things I read, it could have been like appliques that you put over your taillights to make them like decorative.
Oh, I like, they had those in the 60s.
Yeah. I mean, someone could have made them. I don't know. So another neighbor named Ronald Ruggiero also heard the shots, and he said that he saw Bello running west on Lafayette Street towards 16th, and then he heard the screech of tires and saw a white car shoot past him with two black males in the front seat. So it's all confusing. So Carter and Artis.
But basically, white car, two black guys.
Yeah.
Okay.
So Carter and Artis, as I mentioned, they were stopped by the police. They were let go, and they had their friend with them. So they drop Royster off, and then Carter, who was in the back seat, gets in the passenger seat. So at 3 a.m., they get stopped again. This time, they were told, you need to follow us to the police station, and that from there, they were arrested because they were in a white car that had a geometric shape.
Right. And they're two black guys.
And they're two black guys.
And it's 1960.
Yeah. There's a lot of, and it's 1960. So there were some differences between the descriptions given by Bello and Valentine and that of the survivors, like the actual victims that happened, like between the descriptions of the people. They were both, each time it was two black men, but the actual descriptions of
the features,
yeah, were different. So there wasn't any, also there wasn't any forensic evidence other than the shotgun shells or like the, you know, gun, what do you call them? Casings, shell casings. So, but the forensics were able to establish based on the shell casings that there was a 32 caliber pistol and a 12 gauge shotgun that were involved. And they never did recover those weapons. As I mentioned, that they didn't have any forensic evidence to link Carter or Artis to the murders. And during this time, even in the 60s, they did have gunshot residue tests. And
oh,
they were like really common. Like, mm-hmm. It wasn't like a brand new cutting edge thing.
Huh.
They were widely used. But they did not use one in this instance. Because
there were two black men in the 60s?
Probably. I don't know. The lead detective said that he didn't have time to bring in an expert. But he did have time to bring in an expert to do a lie detector test.
Yeah, and isn't it just a swab that you, like, wipe their hands?
I mean, it is now. It might have been more complicated then.
Yeah, I can totally see this, though, because one of these black men happens to have made a little bit of something out of himself.
Mm-hmm. And he had a criminal record, and so how easy is that?
Yeah, it's all wrapped up in a nice little bow.
Yep. So they take the lie detector test. They both pass. But in 1976, they all of a sudden found the second report that said that they had both failed the test.
Wow.
So at the time of their arrest, they were interrogated for 17 hours.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, and they were released, and then they both voluntarily appeared before a grand jury, and the grand jury at that point in time declined to file any charges.
They voluntarily appeared, and the grand jury found not enough evidence to file charges.
Yes. So Al Bello...
But I bet that's not ever brought up.
No. Al Bello, our friend Bello, several months later changed his story, and so the police found out by this time that he had been in the area to act as the lookout for the burglary, and that he had taken the money from the cash register.
Yeah.
So...
could he have actually been telling the truth?
I think he was. I honestly think he was.
That's like the craziest story.
I know. I think up to this point he was telling the truth. Now I think he's not telling the truth. But so while he's being interrogated or like questioned by the police for these other things, he positively identifies Artis as one of the killers. And his accomplice, Arthur Bradley, for some reason, even though he was supposedly in a warehouse, he comes forward and says, Carter's the other one. They have, like, these IDs, like, eyewitnesses now.
Uh-huh. Which makes me think they actually did it.
I still don't know. Like, I don't know. The whole time reading this, I'm like, this is crazy. So, anyway, Carter and Artis are arrested again. This time they're indicted, and so later... Bello claims that he was promised $10,500, which was the reward offered for catching the killers. Uh-huh. But he didn't get the $10,500, so he was mad about that. So he was like, I was supposed to get this money.
Is this before or after he fingered?
After. So what I'm thinking is he was promised the reward money.
If you finger this guy.
Yeah. And then was never paid it and got mad and was like, where's my money? I think I honestly think they didn't have anything to do with this killing. I don't know that for a fact, but this is just my impression. But they were so dumb, and they were just like dumb criminals that they were like, yeah, I took the money from the cash register, and yeah, we were there doing a burglary at the warehouse, but you were supposed to give me this $10,000.
Right. It does seem like a completely far-fetched story enough to be true.
Yeah.
So then it was, they, since they found them, hey, say it's this dude, we'll give you 10 grand. He says it's this dude, and then he never gets his 10 grand.
And then he's mad, and
so he says, it wasn't this dude.
So,
but at that point, how are you supposed to believe him?
Well, no, he never said it wasn't the dude. He just was mad that he didn't get his $10,500.
Okay.
So the car that Artis and Carter had been driving was impounded by police, like, at the time of the first arrest. So they searched it the first time, didn't find anything. And then 5 days after the arrest, a detective, he searches the car again, and he finds two rounds. One's a .32 caliber, and one's from a 12-gauge.
That weren't there before.
That weren't noticed before. So anyway, they...
Or weren't there.
Either or. So they test these rounds, and neither one of them matched the .32 that was in the car.
So they didn't even frame him well.
No, because the .32 that was in the car was brass, and the ones at the scene were copper. And then the shotgun shell was an older model, and it was a different color from the ones that were recovered at the scene.
Oh, my goodness.
And people, like, how, it's not usual that you would have two different color shotgun shells, two different ages, brass and copper. Like, you don't mix all that stuff up.
Well, sometimes you do.
Sometimes you do.
I mean, if you're just like, hey, I want to go shooting, grab from here, grab from here, grab from here.
But the one, the exact ones that are in the car are two completely different types as the ones that were used in the actual killing. It's unlikely.
It's very unlikely. He picked those up from the practice range and threw them in that car.
Yeah.
2 days later. So he's not even framing them well. Like, the other day, the kids, I was doing something with the, talking to my partner teacher about kids cheating. And they'll literally copy the website and paste it, and they don't change the fonts, so you'll see several different fonts on the one page, and they don't take off the bolded words and the underlined words that are used as a link. So I'm like, they're cheating, and they're not even cheating well. And everybody thought that was just,
I remember, hysterical. Back in our old days when you and I were team teaching a particular class, and you had your notebook system.
And yes, I loved my notebooks.
All the work was done in these notebooks. And so...
It was so easy.
We were team teaching this class, and I believe you were teaching on that particular day, and I was, like, grading some of the work. And this one student, who I actually still see every once in a while, had just written complete nonsense. Like, complete nonsense
work. Yes.
And I'm like, I bring it back to her, and I'm like, this is complete nonsense. Uh-huh. Like, do you want to fix this? And she's like, you actually read that?
I've heard that so many times.
And
yeah, we do.
I was like, yeah. And she's like, oh. She's like,
crap.
And she wasn't an idiot. Like, she just was like, had been getting away with doing nothing for so long.
I had once in a class, kids from two different sections share their document. And they both turn it in exactly as is. And she said the same thing. She's like, you read those? Yeah, I do.
Yeah, guess what?
And I noticed first period and fourth period, identical. Anyway, so they're not cheating. They're not framing them well.
Yes. And so then there's another mysterious second report.
More things are found?
Yeah. So during the trial, all of a sudden, these differences with the shell casings were accounted for in this second report.
Oh, how do they explain it?
It doesn't really say in here how they explained it, but so the report was coincidentally... supposedly written 75 minutes after the murder. So my question is, if they had this evidence then, why would they have released the men?
And how, in less than an hour and a half, do you gather all the evidence and complete a report on it?
Yeah.
While you have arrested and let go these people.
Well, and they weren't able to explain how come they weren't, like, tagging and bagging the evidence. Like, it was... none of that stuff was done. It wasn't accounted for.
Oh, my goodness. People really need to commit crimes smarter.
Commit crimes better, as our friend Joe says.
Do better.
If you're considering a life a crime, you're not smart enough for a life of crime.
These are police officers.
That are doing criminal acts.
They're doing criminal acts, but you would think, having witnessed multiple criminal acts and seen where the criminals have gone wrong, that they might do it better.
They don't do it better.
But they're not.
I don't think they thought they had to.
That is probably it. That is the statement of the entire podcast.
Because
they didn't think they had to.
They didn't think they had to. And I'll probably point out why later. But so anyway.
It's 1970 something.
Yeah. So the defense brought up all these different inconsistencies. And they also brought up all this different like inconsistencies with the evidence that were given by eyewitnesses. They also had a witness that said Artis and Carter were still at the Night Spot bar when the shootings happened. And so...
Is this a different bar than the one that was shot up?
Yeah, the Lafayette was the one that was shot up, and okay. Artis and Carter had been at the Night Spot.
See, if it was a few decades later, there would have been credit card receipts.
Yep, always use your credit card when you go to bars at 2 in the morning.
If you have to prove that you were there and not somewhere else doing a crime.
Anyway, unfortunately...
If you're doing a crime, use cash.
Yeah. If you're trying to prove you're not doing a crime, use credit. So the jury ultimately convicted both of them with murder, but they recommended mercy, which meant that they would avoid the death sentence.
We recommend mercy because we know that these guys really didn't do it, and we're just putting them as scapegoats so that we can cross this off.
Basically. So in 1974, Al Bello and his partner Bradley... They withdrew their identifications of Carter and Artis.
Interesting.
So the attorneys tried to use these recantations as the basis for a new trial, but the judge, called Samuel Larner, and I'll say his name, he denied the motion, saying they, quote, lacked the ring of truth.
Everything that those two men had said prior to that point lacked the ring of truth.
Yeah.
But this statement where they're saying, no, we lied, it wasn't them, that actually sounds plausible.
I think that their first statements were plausible, and I think this was plausible, because there was no money.
Their first statements may have been truth. It doesn't sound plausible, though.
Oh, yeah.
I'm
going
to run
crazy.
Into the place where they're shooting to buy cigarettes.
Yeah.
Oh, look, even though I've been chased by a guy with a gun, but oh, look, there's money. I'll steal it.
So, anyway, this is part of the reason why I said that the judge didn't, or that they didn't think they had.
Yeah.
To do better.
Well, they don't with that type of judge.
But this Madison Avenue advertising exec, George Lois, he found out about the story and he organized this campaign. Going back to like the GoFundMes, he was trying to advocate for a retrial or a pardon. And then
good for him.
Muhammad Ali also supported the campaign.
I just am so impressed with him after doing that podcast on him. I love him.
And
amazing.
Then Bob Dylan co-wrote a song called The Hurricane, and then he performed it. I actually have it on my...
Hit me like a hurricane. Not that one.
Not that one. I have it on my phone right here in my Bob Dylan stuff. And he said that he was sure that Carter was innocent. So all the stuff, like, poor artist doesn't get any of the attention on this. It's all Carter because he was the,
he's the celebrity.
Yeah.
That's typical and normal. Totally. Yeah.
So during the 1967 trial, the defense attorneys argued that Bello and Bradley had lied and that they had made deals with prosecutors in exchange for their trial testimony, but that didn't make an impression at the time. But there was a tape of one detective that was interrogating Bello, and when it was played during the recantation hearing that didn't go through, it supposedly said that Bello was being promised some sum of money in exchange for his testimony.
Yeah, $10,000.
$10,500. So finally, in 1976, they are granted a new trial. Bello repeats his same exact testimony, and he identified Carter and Artis. Bradley refused to cooperate this time. And he wasn't called
good
by...
Good for Bradley.
Yeah, he wasn't called by a witness by either the prosecution or defense, so he's out of it.
Why didn't the defense call him?
I think because they didn't think he was reliable, would be my guess.
I guess.
But the jury deliberated for 9 hours, and then they found Carter and Artis guilty again.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. So the judge reimposed their same sentence.
What year is this?
76.
Okay. So it was 60s when the crime happened.
Yes.
And this trial took place in 76. Okay.
Yeah. And then in 1981, Artis was paroled. Carter's attorneys continued to appeal, In 1982, the Supreme Court in New Jersey affirmed his convictions.
Oh my gosh. Because he's probably not willing to say he did it to get out.
No.
Because he's a criminal. He's done crimes. He's done bad things, but he didn't do this.
He didn't do this. He did bad stuff.
Right. But you're not going... It seems like that's the type of person who does that.
Yeah.
I've done bad things. I'll admit that. But I didn't do this. And yep. I'm not going to go down for that.
Yep. So, in 1985, Carter's attorneys filed a petition for a writ of habeas corpus in federal court. So, they took it out of New Jersey into federal court. This writ was granted by Judge Haddon Lee Sarokin. And he said that the prosecution had been, quote, predicated upon an appeal to racism rather than reason and concealment rather than disclosure.
Yeah, think?
And, yeah. And he set aside the conviction.
Yay!
So... Carter was freed without bail in November of 1985.
Meanwhile, his life is gone.
Yep.
Is how many years was he in prison?
Oh, God. Almost 20 years. I think like 19 years. So anyway, the prosecutors declined to refile charges. And so they dismissed the original indictments. Carter gets out of prison. He moves to Toronto. He becomes a Canadian citizen because he, I guess, had it with the U.S.
Uh-huh.
And he...
But he can't box anymore.
No.
How's he gonna make a living?
Well, he's also too old to box.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah. How's he gonna make a living now? That's well, what he did.
So he started this association. It's called the Association in Defense of the Wrongly Convicted. And he did. He was the executive director of that until 2005.
Oh, look at him.
While he was still in prison, he wrote and published his autobiography. It was called The 16th Round, From Number 1 Contender to Number 45472.
That's a sad title.
I know. And then in 1999, his story was made into a major motion picture. It starred Denzel Washington. It was primarily based on his autobiography. And then on April 20th, 2014, Carter died in his sleep after a battle with cancer.
Aw. Not bad, though, to have Denzel Washington play you.
I know. Well, I'm kind of I never saw the movie, but I kind of remember seeing that there was a movie about like some boxer named the Hurricane.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, I use Wikipedia, ESPN.com, NorthJersey.com, Biography.com, and The Daily Beast.
Cool.
So that's my hurricane.
I like it. So hurricanes can be bad, but they can be cool.
Yeah, I mean, there's sometimes there's a reason why a hurricane's a hurricane.
Yes, I like it.
Although I'm not an expert.
No. But kind of drunk after this drink.
Just a little drunk. As always, you can contact us on Facebook at Crime and Time OTR.
On Instagram, we are Crime and Time OTR.
On Twitter, we're at Crime and Time OTR.
And our email is crimeandtimeotr@gmail.com. Email is where you will want to send us cocktail suggestions, things topics. You want to learn about. Yeah.
Or just say hi.
Or just say hi.
And we also have a new Patreon page. Yay! If you want to buy us a drink.
Buy us a drink.
So that is...
Patreon.com/CrimeAndTimeOTR.
And we're going to be offering some perks for our patrons.
Absolutely. I'm excited. See you there.
Thank you for listening.